Dalton Main from our newsroom. Welcome back, guys.
Hey, how you doing, man?
How you doing?
All right, we got it rolling now. And a little bit later, we're going to kind of have a hybrid sort of a program today. We're going to join our friends at Here and Now and talk a little bit about Mississippi River flooding. Residents in Cajun Country are packing their things, ready to evacuate their homes if engineers open a massive spillway and swamp. Thousands of homes down there. We'll have the latest from New Orleans. And also, we're going to hear from the BBC's Roland Burke. He's in Tokyo with a reporter's notebook. He's been traveling in the northeast part of the country, of course, that was devastated by the earthquake and tsunami. We'll hear from Roland Burke a little bit later in the program. But right now, Metro News, and back to Philip M. Bailey. Two big developments this week, Philip. Let's start with the Whiskey Row sale, a sale of some buildings along Main Street, the historic buildings, and an agreement with developer Todd Blue on the others. Now, does this put an end to the preservation dispute that we've heard so much about?
Well, I think we're getting there. I mean, at this point, on Monday, Mayor Greg Fisher announced that there was a deal brokered with local developers, Steve Wilson and Laura Lee Brown, and a number of anonymous investors as well, who will purchase four of the seven buildings from Mr. Blue for $4.8 million. Mr. Blue will donate another building to the Downtown Development Corporation, and two of the buildings he will keep. He will retain two of those. The administration asked for the Metro Council to approve an emergency ordinance that would provide, the city would provide $1.5 million in a grant. Now, Council President Jim King wanted to change that. He changed that to from a grant to a forgivable loan, which means that for every $1 million that private investors put in, the city would put in $100,000. Councilman King says that would protect taxpayers. Still, Council Republicans on Thursday had some questions. There was a fact sheet provided by the administration to council members explaining some details of the deal, but Council Republicans still weren't satisfied. Members of the administration did come to the Minority Caucus meeting, met with Council Republicans, convinced many of them that this was an emergency, that investors would back out if the vote wasn't made on that night. So the council later, with some amendments, approved that measure, approved that deal with a 19-1 vote.
A 19-1 vote. Who cast the nay vote?
Well, Councilman James Peaton, who I talked to earlier today, he says that he's not against preserving the buildings, but that he just didn't like the process, that there wasn't an emergency, it didn't rise to the level of emergency, that there will be no work done on the buildings between now and the next council meeting, so it could have gone through the regular committee process. And essentially what the council suspending the rules does is that instead of going through a committee and being debated there and voted on in the committee and going back to the full council, the council simply introduces an ordinance at that meeting. They vote on it, they debate it, and they vote on it right then and there. Councilman Peaton just said that they're going through that process. He thought was something that we had stopped doing from the old administration, and he was just disappointed in that, and that was why he voted nay.
Now, certain thresholds of investment have to be met in order for this money to be available?
Yes. I mean, you have to have, in order for that $1.5 million forgivable loan to be spent, at least $15 million will have to be provided by the private investors. We still don't know what this project will be. I mean, we don't know. Mr. Wilson or Ms. Brown haven't told us what the plan is for what those buildings might be in the future. And there's also some concern by council members about how much the city did give to Mr. Blue at the end of the day. I mean, he received a $262,000 parking lot for a dollar sold by the city, that will be sold by the city, and 50 parking spaces that have a 20-year value of about $263,000. But overall, I think preservationists who spoke at last night's meeting, council members in the administration, I think all count this as a victory in saving those historic buildings.
How soon will we notice any changes there? When are any construction plans in the works?
It could be years. I mean, next year is when anything would start. I mean, at this point, we still have to have, there's a 60-day limit on the agreement between Mr. Blue and the new investors for them to seal the deal. There still isn't an actual development agreement, which is one of the things that Councilman Peaton had a problem with. There still is no signed document at this point. So any shovels in the dirt, I mean, we've been to this road before with Museum Plaza, any shovels in the dirt, we can project what they will be, but if local investors have said anything won't start until at least 2012.
I see. The other big story of the week from Metro government, and this all broke yesterday, the long-awaited review of Metro Animal Services is out, and an announcement that some big changes are in store for MAS.
Long time coming.
Yeah, long time coming.
If we go back, I mean, this really all started in 2006 under former Mayor Abramson when he appointed Dr. Gilles Maloche as the director of Louisville Metro Animal Services. And what you had since then is a number of ongoing controversies regarding the department. What Mayor Fisher announced yesterday, and Rick, you were there at the press conference, so feel free to chime in, essentially the city is privatizing many of the services that the department is doing, whether adoption, spaying, and neutering. This had been speculated actually for a number of months since Fisher took office. He had appointed his chief of community building, former district judge Sadiqua Reynolds, to oversee those changes in the department. And many employees at the time and other sources had been telling media outlets that they predicted that there would be some shift to privatization by this administration. There still is a question of how that transition will go. The bidding process of giving some of these services over to organizations like Kentucky Humane Society or whoever would end up stepping to the plate to take over those services is still a question. But for a department that has been in the news and a black eye for this city for a number of years, I think for a lot of people, this was something that was sort of a pre-gone conclusion that eventually one day a new administration would wake up and privatize this industry.
So they're sending out requests for proposals, I assume, nationwide.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, well, the search for the director seems to have ended.
Yes.
We don't seem to be going down that path any longer. The city will still retain services such as animal control, meaning that if it's a dangerous dog in your neighborhood or yard, the city would still be in control of that. But the bidding process will begin fairly soon, and I know that many animal groups are interested in the bidding process. Whether this will be seen as a success or failure really depends on what we see in the future.
And I was at the, as you mentioned, at the news conference yesterday, a lot of talk about, and this was in the report, recommending that they shut down this Manslick Road facility that's 45 years old.
Which is sort of, you know, interesting because that was the feather cap of the Abrams administration. Mm-hmm. For a number of years, people were pointing to, well, look at this new shelter we're building, look at, you know, the improvements that we're going to make. But that shelter had been at the center of a lot of the controversies, whether it was the death of certain animals unnecessarily, the euthanasia rate certainly didn't decrease over the time of Dr. Malosh or his replacement, Deputy Wayne Zielinski. And to have those number of leadership shifts, and I think that's what the audit points out, that the leadership, there was really no leadership in that department. For that shelter to be pulled, or the suggestion that it be pulled, I think is a real bad mark for Mayor J. Abramson.
And I guess they'd have to build a new one to accommodate, you know, the services that are going to be provided. I guess it all depends on who comes in and what they do, but not much money in the budget for that right now.
Yeah, facing a $22 million deficit, I don't know where any money for that would come from, but exactly, it all remains to be seen.
Have you had any council reaction, heard any other reaction on the report or the decision to privatize part of the services?
I know that some council members have been hesitant or reticent about it. Councilman Kelly Downer has been out of town, so he's really been out of pocket in a lot of this. And he was involved in the selection committee for a new director. So there hasn't been any active council reaction. There has been some, you know, behind the scenes reaction, but nothing. No one stepped forward with any sort of criticism. I think everyone saw this coming. Everyone knew that the audit wasn't going to be a good one, that it wasn't going to be a good review of the department.
We're talking with Philip M. Bailey and soon in a moment, Dalton Main from the WFPL newsroom. It's State of the News on WFPL. And specifically, we're discussing yesterday's revelation that by Mayor Greg Fisher that part of Metro Animal Services will be privatized, presumably run by a nonprofit, the adoption and sheltering and the care of pets, and the city will maintain control over animal control, the enforcement part of it. Now, there's also talk about they're going to stop doing any spaying or neutering for the public in the meantime. Is that right?
Yeah, and that will end. And that was expected, considering that you had all those problems with the adoptions and animals being brought in. I mean, Sadiqua Reynolds, I believe, at the press conference, Rick, pointed out that the problems really not were just in the leadership, but had trickled all the way down to the employees, that there was a total lack of communication on which animals were to be spayed, which weren't to be spayed or neutered, which animals were to be sent out for adoption, which were going to be euthanized. When you have that level of mismanagement and confusion and dysfunctionality in a department, I don't know if the political will was there on that part of this administration to have a overhaul where the department would retain by Metro government.
The animal shelter in Reno, Nevada, this local committee that sent out this report, studied this best practices, studied various shelters around the country. They hold up Reno, Nevada as the top in the country. And I talked to the director of that shelter this morning, and we'll hear from him next week. But that's a public-private partnership with the Nevada Humane Society, says works very well.
Yeah, and public-private partnerships aren't the end of the world. I think there's the question, though, of if there was a lack of accountability and transparency when the department was a part of city government, will that transparency improve in a public-private partnership. There are those who say no, but I think for the most part for the past 5 years, we've seen that many employees, animal services groups, have stepped up and given the media an insight to what's going on, even when public officials were playing a shell game as far as the department was concerned.
All right, let's move on to another topic, and we'll turn to Dalton Main from the WFPL newsroom. Dalton attended the University of Louisville Board of Trustees meeting, and they have committee meetings as well on the same day. And it looks like a tuition hike at UofL is all but a foregone conclusion now, right?
The Finance Committee passed the gave it approval yesterday. It still has to go before the full board in June, and then it would ultimately need final approval from the State Council on Post-Secondary Education. But it looks like it. I talked to James Ramsey afterwards, and he said that the state statutes say that they have to be a top national university, and he said there's always improvements that need to be made. And the one thing he pointed out is that they could open the gates and just let in more students to try and foot that bill. But he said he wants to stay focused on quality, and he said that requires improvements as well. So he said the tuition increase is just unavoidable at this point. So
when will the full board act on this?
In June. I'm not sure. I didn't catch a specific date, but they said it would be in June. So,
but it's pretty much a done deal now that the Finance Committee has approved it. And this is a 6% tuition hike, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the largest allowed. So,
by the Council on Post-Secondary Education. Any discussion yesterday of the Greg Mortensen matter we've been talking about? He's the Grawemeyer Education Prize winner, but his books, the accuracy of his books and some of his financial dealings have been brought into question. Any discussion on that yesterday?
They did not, or at least they told us they did not. So I would imagine they didn't. There's really not much new in that case. A class action lawsuit was filed in Montana against Greg Mortensen and his charity. Some people claimed, they said, we donated to your institute, but if we had known that this stuff was fake, then we wouldn't have donated, and we want the price of the book back. So that's what they're saying. But there is they have to prove now that is false. They have to prove that he falsified information and knowingly did it. And so the burden of proof is on them now. But that's it. There's no new evidence. Outside Magazine published an article last week where they talked a little bit about his climbing record. Apparently they're saying that they have found no records of him ever having climbed in the Himalayas before. Hmm. Which I'm not sure if in his book that he says he does, but they're saying that they didn't see any proof of that. And they also reviewed the slideshow that he posted on YouTube. His co-author posted a slideshow and narrated it, showing pictures of his journey. And he showed a picture of a bridge that says, this is the bridge that he crossed accidentally to get over the Braldu River and find his way to Corpe. Which that bridge, the picture that they showed, is actually a picture of a bridge over the Biafo Glacier River, which would not lead you to Corpe. And this is all stuff that they've said. So there's little things coming up. More and more people are jumping on this because it's a high-profile thing. But there's nothing definitive. UofL is still just waiting for that. So
yeah, and he has acknowledged that there have been some inconsistencies, I guess, in perhaps in his writings, and that other people have done as well on his behalf.
Mm-hmm. I think people mm-hmm. are entitled to the conflation of events or possibly, mm-hmm. Misconstruing something, but we're still just waiting to see if it was simply something like, oh, whoops, I said that I did this, but, in reality I did this. But we're waiting to see if that's it or if he really was trying to do something that he shouldn't have been doing. But
and he came to notoriety or to fame by establishing schools and whatnot over in Afghanistan, that part of the world.
And right. And that's what everyone's really talking about is he did so many great things. Why are there these little issues that are coming to light? We're waiting to see if those issues are just little things that we should ignore or if they're things that that really sort of cast a negative light over everything he's done, which I guess everyone would say he's done some great things. So it's unfortunate that this is all happening.
We're talking Metro News with Dalton Main and Philip M. Bailey from the WFPL newsroom. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with more in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and we're having our usual Friday news roundup, and we're talking Metro News with Philip M. Bailey and Dalton Main from the WFPL newsroom. Dalton, let's come back to you for a moment. You attended a Metropolitan Sewer District board meeting earlier this week. You Yesterday, you covered the U of L tuition increase, and this is another MSD rate increase. Tell us about that.
They approved an increase of about 4.5%, I believe, which it translates to about $2.15 per month for customers. And they attributed it to the need for about $850 million in improvements to keep in compliance with the Clean Water Act. And Metro Council must approve an increase over 7%, but since this isn't over 7%, they don't have to do that. This increase does go into a 60-day public comment period. I've also heard it reported that it was 30 days, but from what I understand, it's the 60-day public comment period. They're going to go through that. They're going to let people, you know, have their say and everything. But it was actually kind of an exciting board meeting because there were several interruptions. There was a guy that was there to have his say, but he had gone through the public comment process, which you have to apply to be, you know, recognized to speak at the meeting. And then Bud Shardine has the say on whether or not it gets approved. And he said he didn't really like he didn't really like that process. So he decided to just come and see if he could talk. And, of course, the board's legal counsel, Larry Zilke, jumped up and called him out of order and said, you know, we have to get this, you can't do this. We're going to have to get you out of here. And of course, consistent MSD critic Ray Pierce stood up and said, you know, well, who's controlling this meeting? The board, you know, the board or the attorney? And so it was exciting for a moment. So, other than that, you know, routine increase, you know, they need to make improvements. Bud talked a lot about the success that the flood protection system saw over the last month. So, they're just looking to keep everything going. So
this is part of this federal mandate to clean up the sewer system, improve the sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, Philip, let's go back to you and the Metro Council for a moment. A lot of activity lately. Of course, last week, Mayor Greg Fisher announced a plan that would reopen Kentucky Kingdom next year, in 2012.
They hope.
They would hope next week. A lot of kids would probably hope, too. And now you've gotten some Metro Council reaction to that. This was called for a $17.5 million bond issue, among other actions.
Sure. Members of the council are certainly encouraged by Mayor Fisher's plan to reopen Kentucky Kingdom. The closure of Kentucky Kingdom obviously was something that happened before he took office and certainly was an issue in the mayoral campaign. Because it employs so many young people and is seen as an economic engine for this community, council members and even beyond the city legislators have shown certain concern for it. I know that Mr. Ed Hart had wanted the city to step forward before with a bond plan, and the city said that, no, we're not really ready for that. But after sitting back at the negotiation table, which I think is a theme of the Fisher administration, the idea of negotiation, they were able to come together and call for the city to issue $17.5 million in bonds. Council members are encouraged by that, but you know, Councilman Marianne Butler, the chair of the budget committee, says that reopening the park will certainly be an important boost, particularly for young people. However, she wants that to be used as an industrial revenue bond instead, which she believes will have less risk for the taxpayers. So that's something that happened before Derby, and I think it'll certainly come up again as council members begin to debate the issue. It may come up during the budget proposals and the budget debate, but the question really is a matter of semantics and a matter of just changing it a little bit if the council wants it to be an industrial revenue bond instead of just a regular bond that the mayor has proposed.
And we haven't heard publicly from Ed Hart on this latest offer, have we?
No, he's been relatively quiet. I mean, he had petitioned state government, didn't get anywhere there, and had failed initially with Metro government, was successful in getting this bond through with the city agreed to it, but that requires that a private partner come forward. So I believe that Mr. Hart has said that he's trying to find that private partner who will step up and form this public-private partnership with the city to reopen the amusement park. But he's been relatively quiet on this, and I don't know if that means anything one way or the other. He may just be too busy working on trying to get the deal done and complete.
Let's move on to the LG&E franchise agreement with the city. There was discussion, at least, on it earlier this week, and you covered that.
Yeah, as Dalt was mentioning, the rates of MSD, another rate increase that people were certainly paying attention to was the proposal by the Fisher administration to put an additional franchise fee in the new agreement with Louisville Gas and Electric. That contract agreement has not been renewed since 2003. No one's really sure why it's taken so long or why the Abramson administration never renewed that agreement. But the one proposed by the Fisher administration would call for a 3% increase for users in the old City of Louisville, the Urban Service District, and the incorporated parts of merged government that wouldn't include smaller unincorporated parts of the city, including places like Shively or Seneca Gardens or Prospect or St. Matthews, these smaller cities that were never incorporated as a result of merger. That would leave about 20% of the population, or about 145,000 people, who would not be affected by this rate increase. Council members who say they would be supportive of the rate increase as a way to raise revenue and to reinstitute certain city services said that they couldn't support the bill, the measure, because it's totally unfair in their view. The council decided to table that indefinitely. The Fisher administration proposed taking this to state government, to the General Assembly next year, to change state law. That would have larger ramifications, because that wouldn't just affect Jefferson County, it would affect all 120 counties in the state. So there's been no indication that the Jefferson County delegation or any state lawmaker is willing to take that issue on. It would be the first change to merger law since 2003. We haven't seen any amendments whatsoever since voters passed it in November of 2002. So the likelihood of this franchise agreement being renewed and passing this year seems to be very low. There was a general resistance to this rate increase, particularly among council Republicans, who called this basically a backdoor tax on the residents of Louisville to reinstitute certain services.
So expand a little bit statewide, talk a little bit of politics. Of course, the primary election is coming up on Tuesday. It looks like David Williams, the clear front runner in the Republican primary.
Yes, in the Republican gubernatorial race, you have State Senate President David Williams running up against Louisville businessman Phil Moffitt, who's backed by the Tea Party, and longtime county clerk, Jefferson County clerk, Bobby Holtzclaw. In that race, Mr. Williams is clearly the favorite, not only in the polling, in the fundraising. So you see, I think, a widening of the gap in that race. The question, though, is with a turnout projected anywhere between 9 to 10%, will Mr. Williams voters simply sit back and say, well, he's going to win, he's the favorite, I'm not really worried, I'm going to stay home? Mr. Moffitt and Ms. Holtzclaw believe that with that low turnout projected, if their supporters are energized enough, they can certainly pull off an upset. The problem with that, though, is that Williams is probably the only of those three of those candidates who has any statewide name recognition. He's been the state Senate president. He's had these jousts with Governor Beshear on a number of issues, particularly gaming, for the past 4 years. Mr. Moffitt and Ms. Holtzclaw aren't that well known in the state outside of Jefferson County. So the likelihood of that really depends upon the ability for them to get an organization in their campaign that will get that vote out. But neither one of them appears to have a strong organization outside of Jefferson County. Mr. Moffitt, however, I think would argue that he does, considering he's backed by the Tea Party. But at this point, it's safe to say that Mr. Williams is the clear favorite. But there's always a possibility of an upset.
Governor Steve Beshear, Democrat, unopposed, has a new running mate, Jerry Abramson, familiar name around here. Because the current Lieutenant Governor Mongiardo ran unsuccessfully for the Senate, is not on the ticket. A little bit of a dust-up from a week ago. President Obama came down to Fort Campbell to visit the troops and also to congratulate this team that took out Osama bin Laden. The governor came under some criticism for not meeting the president there and instead going to Kentucky Oaks activities.
What's been dubbed Snubgate.
Snubgate. Right.
From the local blogs to the national news. The governor decided, he said basically that he got short notice from the White House, that it was too late in the day. The media was informed about this visit around 6 o'clock, so there were those who were questioning whether the governor did receive this message late or not, but he said that he couldn't change around his schedule, that he had obligations at the Kentucky Oaks. He was meeting with business leaders who wanted to meet with the governor, who wanted to see the chief executive officer of the state of Kentucky. President Obama certainly isn't popular in the state. I think his negative approval ratings have been in the 30s in the state of Kentucky. But this was his first visit to the Commonwealth as president. There are many of his supporters and others who said that, you know, these two men are in the same party. It's the president of the United States. Off the heels of killing the most notorious terrorist in the world. If he's not going to be popular now enough for you, he never will be. The critics, you know, particularly Raul Cunningham, the president of the Louisville NAACP, said that if the governor's playing hide and seek with the president, voters, particularly African American voters, may play hide and seek with him in November. It's yet to be determined if people will keep that on their minds up until November. But I think certainly this was a lose-lose situation for Governor Beshear. If he had showed up, he would certainly been beaten up by his Republican opponents who are already running against President Obama, particularly his health care plan. But if he had showed up, if he hadn't have showed up, he was certainly going to be criticized for snubbing the president. This may be a matter of the governor listening more to his political consultants than his own political courage.
Oddly enough, President Obama came to Indianapolis probably the week prior, and I believe he met with None other than Governor Mitch Daniels.
He met with Governor Daniels, who is mulling over his own presidential bid. And those two, you know, met under, I think it was pleasant circumstances. There was no acrimonious gaffes or flubs from that meeting. So, yeah, it certainly wasn't a good week for the Governor Beshear, in the sense that here he was, it seemed to be, from critics, avoiding the president. And as Raul Cunningham mentioned to me in an interview, saying that he feels that the governor essentially is just afraid of President Obama. The president, I don't know if he could be more popular off of the heels of killing bin Laden, but at the same time, obviously his political consultants and others would likely have advised the governor not to be there with President Obama, but this could be spun either way. I mean, there could be ads later on in the general election where we see the Republicans saying that the governor snubbed the troops, that he didn't want to meet with the troops who fought in Afghanistan or had killed bin Laden himself. So there's a lose-lose situation for Beshear, but I don't know if this will translate into any effects in the general election.
All right, Philip, thank you very much. And I'm going to give you the last word here, Dalton. We've got about a minute left. You did some exploring on what kind of weather we can expect here in the Louisville area this summer. What did you find out?
Well, like always, you never know what to expect. But the National Weather Service said that spring rains, a lot of it can cool off the weather in the summer because of the moisture in the ground. But they said that there's a strong prediction for a colder than average summer up near Chicago, and then a hotter than average summer down in the southwest near Phoenix. And they said Louisville's sort of right in between that. So they said it's kind of a toss-up.
So warm and humid this summer with a chance of thunderstorms is pretty much what we can expect as we do every year. And just a few seconds left, there was an announcement about halfway to Forecastle, and then they're putting off the actual Forecastle Festival for a while, right?
Mm-hmm. The actual main event has been postponed to next year because it's the 10th anniversary, and they've just partnered with AC Entertainment, who does Bonnaroo Music and Arts Festival. And they were expecting a huge event next year. So they've pushed the halfway to Forecastle into the spotlight this year with Pretty Lights and Outkast member Big Boy, who will be headlining it.
Big Boy.
All right. Let's head on down to New Orleans now. We're going to get an update on the Mississippi River flooding from our colleagues at Here and Now. This is State of the News at WFPL.